I'm Christopher Lydon with the writer and literary critic Catherine Ann Powers in my house in Boston. She is the daughter of a famous father, the novelist and short story master J.F. Powers. But she's outdone him, I think, this year, 14 years after his death, with a curious and much remarked book. She assembled it, really. It's his autobiography in letters. But it reads like the novel J.F. Powers meant to write and never did, about the family life of an Irish-American and very Catholic artist in the 20th century Midwest. We're talking about ironies, disappointments, and human contradictions, heartbreaking and hilarious, of a religious imagination in mid-century America. And Catherine, I'm presuming to take it personally. I'm hearing a lot of my family story in yours. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. To put my feeling directly, Catherine Powers, I think you've composed, out of your father's letters, a bigger novel than he ever wrote. And let's remember that his best novel, Mort Durban, won the National Book Award 50 years ago in a head-to-head race with Nabokov's Pale Fire and John Updike's Pigeon Feathers, among others. I was more absorbed by your book, Suitable Accommodations, an autobiographical story of family life, the letters of J.F. Powers. One test of a man's family life, of course, is how his kids remember him. Start simply. What was this stylish and selfish man, this blocked and elegant writer, like as a daddy?
Well, let's start with the good things. He didn't beat us up. He didn't drink to excess. He didn't womanize. He was very entertaining when he felt like being entertaining. He was good at telling stories and making up things. So when he was in a good mood, we were all in a good mood. But he was often not in a good mood because he was stalled in his writing. And then he was pretty hard to take. But I think that's true of most people. The person who comes through, or I should say the persona who comes through in the book, in the letters, is to some extent a fictional character. He created this person that he called Jim, which was the guy writing the letters, although he wouldn't have put it this way. He wouldn't have said that he created this, but he was doing this, creating this extremely embattled man, embattled chiefly by family, by having too many children, too little money, and a wife who seemed to object to some of that, at least the lack of money. And also, he would sort of boast of his laziness and boast of his selfishness. And to some extent, it was a shtick. To some extent, it wasn't. He certainly had good material to work with.
Let's remember, he had five kids, and he was never on for that job. I mean, I wondered how you felt reading and then publishing from a letter to Robert Lowell, the poet, on your birth. He said, "We had a baby, a girl." And he goes on to say, "The baby is crying like hell now. I'm not liking it one bit and do not expect to grow used to it. What a foul fiend I am to have for a father." And he wasn't kidding. He went on, he says, "You ask me how it feels to be a father. About the same, I think. Except I have a few stipulations to read into the rural life, family life jive that circulates in these liturgical parts. If you must get married, I say to young people, be sure you can afford a 15-room house and servants." That came as a blow to them. They read The Catholic Worker and all the rest and are accustomed to thinking in terms of Mary and Joseph and the manger. We have the manger, but we are not Mary and Joseph. Anyway, we are not Joseph.
That sums it up. Exactly. He really made hay with that whole picture of himself as this embattled person by the whole business of family life, the existence of children and the lack of means.
Place him in that time among his friends, like Robert Lowell, yeah. Catherine Ann Porter, among his rivals. He didn't like Faulkner. He didn't like all sorts of people. But he was a New Yorker writer. I think it was Paul Eli who wrote, having J.F. Powers in the New Yorker for Catholics was like having JFK in the White House. And it was the same time. Mm-hmm. But place him as an artist.
Well, he was part of what is sometimes called the Catholic Renaissance of letters, but as Dana Joya has just pointed out in a really excellent essay in First Things, December 2013, that it wasn't really a renaissance because it wasn't a rebirth of anything. It was a sort of a first flowering of American letters that basically thrived in the 40s and 50s, and my father, J.F. Powers, was one of those people. The others were somebody called Harry Sylvester, who kind of dwindled, but he and my father were considered to be neck and neck as the great white hope, as it were, of Catholic letters, which is to say, art that was not pious and drenched in religiosity, and it wasn't about the baby Jesus, and it wasn't about miracles, well, gross miracles, and so on. Other people, well, later, Flannery O'Connor, then, and Catherine Ann Porter. Robert Lowell was a Catholic for only a short period of time, so I don't know that we can really count him. Very much wringing of hands and sobbing when he left the church on the part of these champions of Catholic letters. I can't remember who else, but let me just say how he got himself into that predicament of having the manger, but not having any servants in the 15-room house. He was born from extremely ordinary parents in Jacksonville, Illinois, and they moved up finally to Quincy, Illinois, and then his parents moved to Chicago. His father worked for Swift, which later became Swift Premium, and was out of work during the Depression. But he was first a middle manager, and then he was laid off during the Depression, and then became an accountant. Very ordinary person. His mother had gone to college, an unusual thing in those days. Once again, this happens in so many of these Irish, American Irish households. The woman is more educated than the man.
Mine too.
Yeah, exactly. And so my father sort of imprinted on that, I would say, though that sounds like a scientific observation. Believe me, it isn't. In any case, he graduated from high school, a good high school, Quincy Academy, run by Franciscans, and he wanted to get a job. He also wanted to be a writer, but he did want to get a job. Impossible. He graduated in 1936, became a chauffeur. He tried selling encyclopedias and things like that. He finally got jobs in bookstores, which opened his eyes to the horror of commercialism as he saw it, and was finally fired from, I think it was Brentano's, because he wouldn't buy war bonds. By this time, it was 1941 or two. And so he lost his job, and then he had sort of, he went on a retreat in Oakmont, Pennsylvania, run by a person called Father John Hugo, who was a detacher. Now, we must stop and talk about what the detachers were.
I want to hear about it. Out there in the Minnesota Catholic movement, they called themselves detachers. Gene McCarthy and his wife Abigail were detachers. But what did it mean to them?
First of all, lay people didn't remain, or even clerics for that matter, didn't remain detachers for long. What it meant was a complete turning of one's back upon fleshly pleasures. They were frowned upon by the church hierarchy because they were considered to be pretty much Jansenist, which is a heresy. And Jansenism is a dualistic idea which believes that the material things are evil and the spiritual things are good. That's where you're in harmony with God. Irish Catholicism in the olden days used to be fairly Jansenistic. The material world, usually associated with the woman, was bad. The detachers definitely had this idea. And the spiritual world, the man, was considered to be the higher, more spiritual power, sort of purity of essence, as you might say.
And sex that connected the two was entirely suspect.
It was suspect. And it was something that one had to understand in married people would happen. It would happen. But it was not something that you would definitely congratulate yourself on. The idea was to mortify the flesh in order to be closer to God. My father attached himself to the detachers and had friends who were detachers, mostly priests. He didn't like the turning his back on earthly, on fleshly pleasures. He loved beer and good food and camaraderie and beautiful fabrics and beautiful things. But what he liked about it was its rejection of American materialism. And in his view, it would be kind of a rejection of vulgarity. That's how it came through in him.
It was also, you have to mention, rejection of the war, World War II. He was a conscientious objector. He believed it. He got a 3-year sentence. He never questioned whether he would serve. I think he did 18 months in jail. And that was a big piece of it.
Yeah. Yes, they were pacifists, and that he embraced. He embraced its rejection of American militarism and American materialism. And then he made friends around St. John's Abbey and University in Minnesota, went to another retreat there, held by detachers. But there he made the acquaintance of these people who were called the Catholic Rural Life Movement.
Yeah.
And they weren't detachers. They rejoiced in the good things of the earth. They were beekeepers, for instance. You couldn't move for bees in that part of the country.
It sounds so much more and more like my parents.
Yeah. That's the strain that I'm most sympathetic towards. And that's the strain that he sort of embraced, theoretically.
It was across the board. It was St. John's Abbey in those days. They did their own style of Christmas cards. Mm-hmm. Food, living, family life, art. It was all one big thing. Let me just say, though, Catherine, what fascinated me about your book, and I can't get it out of my head, is the Catholic piece. And I think that element of it is familiar to all sorts of people who grew up in religious families, not necessarily Catholic, though especially of the Irish Catholic persuasion, and people who remains in some sympathy with even church religion, and I do. But it's complicated. The thing your book reminded me of was that Catholicism in those days, out of the 50s and 40s, after the war, was a distinct choice, and it was a life. It was not a sort of ethnic or voting identification. It was not a reluctant, you know, checkoff. It was a whole notion of living differently. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of beautiful. And I want to track where in the world that went mm-hmm. in our life, as well as the kind of constant presence of Catholic writers, Catholic celebrities, you know, Fulton Sheen, some of them attractive, some not. But the other piece of it, though, is the puritanical, Jansenist mm-hmm. piece. And your father had a strong dose of that. I mean, there's something of the misanthrope in your Christian father. There was very little Jesus, as you say. There was not a whole lot of kindness, organized charity, accepted suffering, etc. And so it remains for me a huge riddle. But where do you want to start? It's that whole nexus of Catholic attitudes, which have almost entirely, to my eye, disappeared.
Yeah, they have almost entirely disappeared. And it is something of a mystery, but I think it's the mystery that's solved by one answer, which is the usual answer in America, television and the consumer society. It just wiped out a lot of things. It wiped out crafts in the home, you know, everybody doing his own or her own little job, and that idea of work and labor being a prayer, you know, which is...
Mine was to milk the cow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure you had one.
Well, we didn't, because as much as my father idealized these things, he couldn't bear it. But let me just say this about that. So St. John's was also involved with liturgical reform and lay participation. These things were anathema to him, as indeed rural life became anathema to him, because it was so damp and cold, and there were so many animals involved, and so much that wasn't elegant. But he enjoyed, because his friends all embraced this, his letters just revel in their trials.
He was the Catholic writer. He was mm-hmm. known as the guy who wrote about priests, mm-hmm. the way Ringlardner wrote about baseball players. I mean, that was his shtick.
It was.
Not exclusively, but consistently. And yet there's so little, shall we say, Christianity mm-hmm. in his work. This is a guy who talked the talk in certain ways, but not extravagantly and not sentimentally, but he didn't walk the walk and didn't seem to trouble about that at all.
No, he was fascinated by priests. He was fascinated by the dual nature of their jobs, the making the religion work on earth and making the religion work in heaven. Mm-hmm. And that they had all the temptations and trials and fulfillments of a businessman, but they had another calling, or they had another duty, which in fact contradicted that. He loved contradictions. I think if he could have ever written about another subject, it would have been politics.
He disdained, as my parents must say did, John F. Kennedy in 1960. Mm-hmm. He said, if we're going to have a Catholic, shouldn't it be Gene McCarthy?
True.
A much more, shall we say, religious mm-hmm. figure and type. He wrote endlessly about the politics of the rectory, mm-hmm. the priest and his curate and his maid or housekeepers, and mm-hmm. this kind of personal relationship. But it seemed to me he never got into politics as politics. I wish he'd written more about family. I wish he'd written the novel that you've mm-hmm. you've done now.
I don't think he could have actually in the end. He did write it in his letters, which I claim in my introduction, and I believe it to be so. It is obviously not a novel, but it is somewhat fictional, and it does have an arc, and it is a subject that he's extremely interested in. But I don't think he could have pulled it off if he'd consciously done it as a novel, because he'd have to look at himself in a way that I think he couldn't bear. Another thing he couldn't accept was death. When people died, he would never tell anybody. When my sister, Mary, died in 1992, and he was living in Minnesota, surrounded by my mother's relatives, he never told anybody. He didn't tell them that his daughter had died, my mother's sister, and so on. They finally found out, and I asked him why, and he said, I just didn't want to be confronted with the old tear in the eye. He had genuine emotions, but I think he felt that they couldn't be pulled off right. I think he felt that expressing emotion was an art that he couldn't master, and neither could anybody else. And so he was just going to steer away from it. There's a bit from one of these letters that you liked, which I think shows his attitude towards death as well. Let me just get this here. Here's a letter written in 1957 discussing having given a talk at the University of Detroit, a Catholic university, which had a big turnout, and he describes it. In any case, he ends by saying, "Before I close, I want to say that there were some wonderful faces among the clergy there last night. One wonderful old man, whom I'd been conscious of during the reading, came up and said I was too kind of the clergy. We're worse than that, he said. This was nice, but irrelevant to my real interest, which was in him, himself. What a wonderful face! So round, the hair so white, the eyes blue. I hated to think of him dying, as he would in a few years. All that perfection disappearing from the earth."
How did the man, so famous for writing about priests, miss the poison in the rectories too?
That's a really good question. I think that he did miss it. I think that he felt the two big temptations for priests, aside from sloth and time serving and empire building and all that, the things that he wrote his stories about, were women and drink. And women, seen from the point of view, is that women would be trying to seduce you, not so much that you would try to seduce women. So he would put it that way. And drink. But I don't think he had any idea about the abuse of children. In the late 90s, a couple of years before he died, he talked to me about a friend of his, a priest. And this was after other priestly friends of his had got married and had been caught with women and so on and so forth, all to be expected by him. But this is when the terrible revelations were beginning to come out. Particularly, there was a particularly bad case in Minnesota. I think the guy's name was Porter. He had abused something like 80 children. But in any case, my father, we were talking, and then all of a sudden he looked really grave, and he said, "I think Father Blank has done something really terrible." And I said, "What do you mean?" And he looked so haunted and shocked and ravaged. He said, I can't tell you, but I think he's done something really terrible." And that, I think, probably had to do with children.
So he was in that general void of denial that all of us were.
Yeah. Which is extraordinary, given that his best friends were priests. He knew about all the drunks. And he later learned about the women, the adult women, although that he didn't care for in the least.
Was he a wannabe priest himself, Catherine?
No.
There is a line, and again, how many layers of irony, but he says in one letter, "If I had my life to live over, I'd join the Clementine Fathers," which was an order that he had invented. Mm-hmm. But what did that mean?
That's one of his jokes. He definitely wouldn't have. He didn't want to be a priest. He liked priestly fellowship. He liked sitting around with priests, as indeed his priests in his fiction like sitting around with each other and you know, these bull sessions that they would have. But he couldn't have borne the celibacy, number one, but he couldn't bear having to deal with people. That was the main thing.
But there's the fundamental puzzle for me. His priests are golfers, they're drinkers, they're gadabouts, they're sports fans, they go to football games, whatnot. But were they religious people, as we would think of them today?
I guess, but that would be something that he would find hard to write about as well, the religious experience. I guess he does somewhat in the Lion's Heart's Leaping Does, a little bit. That has a touch of the mystical experience in it. I think he assumed that they were, but it wasn't something he was going to write about.
Speak of your mother in all this. She was a writer, in some ways more successful and very gifted. She has some of the best lines in the book, some of the funniest, the most incisive. But how did she take this guy who warned her long before they married that he was not going to be a good provider, was not much interested in children, was going to be lazy and a real burden? Mm-hmm. How did Betty Wall Powers manage?
Well, first of all, she didn't believe it. You know, no matter how many times he told her, and he told her in those first letters of the book, again and again, he says, don't think that you can turn me into a Dagwood. Don't think you can turn me into the person who makes a living, and so on. But meanwhile, my mother was being advised by a person called Sister Mariella Gabel, who was quite a force in Catholic literature at the time, and was also, and my mother was her prize student at St. Benedict's College, which was the sister college to St. John's University. Sister Mariella Gabel, she was encouraging my mother to marry this man, and they would talk it over, and they would say, well, he doesn't, must not really mean that. I mean, obviously, if he has children, he's going to make a living or something. Sister Mariella Gabel was encouraging my mother to make this marriage. There's no question that she felt would be a feather in her veil to have this marriage come off, because she felt that the two of them were going to be great writers. She actually believed they probably would make money out of writing, but they didn't. And so my mother didn't believe it in the beginning. And then she loved him. She absolutely adored him. Worshipped him would be not too strong. And she was going to stick with him through thick and thin. And there were plenty of arguments, and they were about his laziness. They were always about his laziness, not about him turning down the many jobs that he turned down when they had no money. She never criticized him for that. But she wanted to know what the hell he was doing in his office all day when he'd go off with his six newspapers and his one bottle of Guinness for his lunch, and then he would come back having announced that he'd bought a captain's table or something, or a lantern, or in other words, he'd spent the whole day at the auctions.
He writes, no money is the story of my life. Money, money, money. This is the answer to every question confronting me.
Mm-hmm. It is. But he actually thought that people should be giving him money, supporting him. That was one element of many that he liked about the Middle Ages, that people would have patrons. And indeed, he did have a patron in the shape of Father Egan, who bailed him out again and again. And my mother's parents gave them money now and again. Every time they had a baby, they got a huge check, you know, $700 or something like that, which is a hell of a lot of money. And they were going to buy my parents a house. They'd already bought them the land for the first house that they lived in, the place that had the manger, which was it was a terrible place. Then they were going to buy them another house, but they wanted it to be in Minnesota. They weren't going to buy them a Georgian pile in Dublin, which my father would have liked. And it would have been a disaster because he couldn't fix anything except for his shoes, which he spent days diddling with.
Speak about Ireland. Ireland was cast always as a solution to the money problem. They could live cheaply there, but it was so much more complicated than that. And I think my parents felt the same lure of the old country, but it was also a kind of retreat, getting out of things, accepting a kind of failure. He has so many funny lines about it. He says at some point, what we did in Ireland was move up a caste with our American money, and it went further there. He says later, this is early 1960s, and Ireland was sort of pre-modern then. He says, the young men look positively cretinous here and all dress like burglars. But as Betty says, there's no more depressing sight on earth than Irish snazzy. Mm-hmm. What was that Irish thing all about?
Well, first of all, it had to do with Irish writing. James Joyce was a pivotal influence on him.
And Beckett probably without his knowing it entirely.
Exactly, without his knowing it. But he was drawn there by the writing. He felt that it wouldn't be materialistic in the way that he felt the United States was. He felt that it was a simpler society, and also he identified with his Irish blood, although he was only about a quarter Irish in his background and mostly German. Anyway, so when they went there, he was just simply smitten by the country, and that was 1951.
He writes so beautifully. Times are considered very hard in Ireland, he writes. This is 1957. Much unemployment, and I can believe it. On the other hand, an Englishman who runs a cafe in Dalkey told me that nobody suffers in Ireland, not as he understands the term. He talked a lot with the hardware man about people who were leaving Ireland for the States and Canada. He says, Anyone leaving Greystones for anywhere else will miss the scenery, I know. There are moments when the sun, filtered by the clouds, shines on the sea and on stone and on the green in such a way that I wonder if such moments aren't enough to make up for everything.
Yeah, well, that's good. Then he goes and he extols Ireland in this manner. And then, I'm not quite sure if it's the same. This is perhaps a different letter. But in any case, he says, there's something rotten about religion here, I think, and something great. Both to an extent, I suspect, that we don't have in America. Little boys and girls, all patches and hobnailed shoes or rubber boots without stockings, kneeling for half an hour at a time, apparently praying. I don't remember anything like that where I come from. Of course, the gigglers and punchers are here, too, but the others stay with me. On the other side, there are many hard-faced women, some in black shawls, and I'm not so pleased by the look of them. Perhaps they all had drunks for husbands, or perhaps they didn't have husbands to avoid the inevitable. I don't know. And then, a couple of days before, he'd written in his journal, I don't feel right about the church here. Even thought the poor Protestants might be holding back the deluge, one finger in the dike, and I think that's actually true. There was a hardness, a real hardness about religion in Ireland then, that we know now to have had a physical expression in those terrible laundries, the orphanages,
right,
and the reform schools, and in the parishes, in the rectories, and terrible. It's totally destroyed religion in Ireland. It's dead.
Yeah.
Deader there than it is here. Completely dead.
Mm. In some sense, we rely on novelists to see through to that reality.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't take it that far.
No, he didn't.
Catherine, as you said at the beginning, I mean, this is an amazing novel. Mm-hmm. With his own created persona in the letters, mm-hmm, but also in your assembling of a story. Mm-hmm. And I'm still puzzled what to make of it. There's so much beauty in it. There's so much appreciation of beauty. There's so much frustration. There's so much sort of kicking at the traces when he might have been working. What's the novel about in the end? Who is this novel character that you've pulled out of the story?
Well, I think the title, which came to me, you know, was really an inspiration. I found it in his letters, Suitable Accommodations. That's what he was looking for, Suitable Accommodations.
And let's mention, he had an obsession about houses.
Yes.
He was always mentioning houses.
Yeah.
Georgian mansions or hovels or whatever. He noticed every house.
Yes, he did. And throughout his life, he was looking for suitable accommodations. He considered himself a jewel, quite frankly. And he was looking for a setting that set him off correctly.
Mm.
And he never found suitable accommodations in that sense, and he was never able to make suitable accommodations to the world. He considered himself a realist, a person who saw very clearly what was going on and that other people didn't.
Mm.
But what he actually didn't see was what was going on. He didn't see that you can't move back and forth and back and forth with this trail of children and expect things to work out. It took a terrible toll on his writing. It would be six months before he'd even put a pen to, well, typewriter key to paper after each move. And to some extent, that was a delaying tactic. In another way, it was restlessness, impatience, thinking it's got to be better wherever they came from. It always, when we'd be in Ireland, they'd immediately regret it. We'd go back to Minnesota, and immediately they'd regret it.
Oh, my God.
Back and forth.
It doesn't come up in your book, but it seems to me there's so much Chekhov in this man's life. Chekhov, as Harold Bloom says, the indispensable artist of the unlived life, mm-hmm, but also, of course, the short story master, tremendous realist, who makes a lot of room for mystery and spirit without quite embracing it. But it seems to me this is a Chekhovian story of, in some sense, opportunity missed.
I agree with you. I couldn't have put it better myself. Yeah, I agree with you. I can't expand on that. Yeah.
No, but do.
Well, I'd like to read a bit from another letter from Ireland that kind of expresses what I was saying and to an extent what you're saying. This is November 29th, 1958, and we're moving from Ireland back to the United States again. The last night in the old house, this, by the way, was an old Georgian. It was incredibly cold, but it was a beautiful, beautiful place. Cold inside, not particularly cold outside. The last night in the old house, down to the furniture that was here when we came, and Huey, my brother, whose bed has gone on before him, crying out from the foreign couch. We have 11 packing cases, 5 trunks, and a number of small pieces. We may live in our packing cases, some of which are quite roomy. We have been through all this before, but this is the worst time yet. Too much stuff, too many people. We have 2 little leather tags, and I found myself switching the little cards around tonight, rather Betty did, and thought it all too ironic. On one side, the cards say, J.F. Powers, Greystones, County Wicklow, Ireland. On the other, care of Arthur Wall, North River Road, St. Cloud, Minnesota. The latter is showing now. Well, there it is. When I think of home as a child, I think of trunks and suitcases. I remember every suitcase intimately, every trunk. I remember the inside of the trunks. I remember the smell of those trunks. And that was our home. We were just back and forth, and it was an unlived life because it was always getting ready to get going.
Here's another sort of summing up from his journal. This is before his big success with Mort Durban, a huge critical success. Some people said he was the best prose writer in America, did not sell big time. He was angry with Doubleday, etc. But this is a couple of years before that, as he was writing the book. I was asking what it is my present life seems to be saying to me. I think it is that I must work willy-nilly and abandon all hope of living as I'd like to, forget what I like to eat, who I'd like to see, where I'd like to be, etc., and think of myself as just having been given a stiff prison sentence. If I should ever get out, it would be nice to have a book or two to show for the time. I'll not get out either until I have a book that makes me some money. So what? My life is a plot against living, but perhaps a good thing for my work, if I can ever get around to it, if I can stop trying to think of other ways to escape the trap I'm in.
Mm-hmm. Well, he just had to knuckle down. He had writer's block. It's hard to us, he seemed lazy. To us, he seemed to be always delaying. I mean, we didn't really know what he did in his office, but we did know that no money was coming in. And the older we got, the more we knew that. And it's just too bad. When he was old, before he died, he knew that he'd wasted his life. And when my mother died, so that's 1988, 11 years before him, he told me that he had spent the last hour or two of her life, she died at home, telling her how sorry he was for the life that he'd given her, which is to say the life he hadn't given her, and how he loved her and how he terribly regretted how hard he had made it for her. By that time he'd realized that he'd wasted his life.
I would have wanted to argue with him on that point. I mean, there's some beautiful work there, but what I'm really interested in is how it shaped you and your sibs. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering a little bit about myself too. These somewhat impractical, very idealistic, serious, purposeful Catholics who you could say, in your father's case, certainly didn't get the whole job done.
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, let me take back. He didn't waste his life, but he felt that he could have made much more out of it. That he'd waste a lot. He wasted a lot of his life. And as far as us, well, my one just the most palpable thing is a terror of homelessness on my part.
Wow.
And I don't know if that's really affected anything that happened to me, but I do know I absorbed their view of the priority of art overall, that yes. It's more important than possessions. It's more important than practically anything except for health. I have absorbed that, and I guess my siblings have as well. My sister, who's dead, who died in 1992, was a very well-known printmaker and artist and ran something called the Graphic Studio. And my other sister, Jane, writes about gardens and writes for the English Times Irish version.
Uh-huh.
And my two brothers, one is a photographer and the other is an artist. So,
that's a huge gift, to give you a kind of general disdain of of wealth or, you know, idle commercial striving and keep your eye on things of spirit and beauty.
It is a great gift. It takes such a burden off one.
I hope he'd be happy with your book, and I hope he'd be happy that we're talking about him, too.
Some days I think that he'd like the book, and some days I think he wouldn't like the book. I really don't know.
I just want to end on the note where we began. I think it's as good as any book he ever wrote, and I think it's a tremendous novel based on a character like him. Catherine Powers, thank you for suitable accommodations, and thank you for this conversation.
Thank you very much. This is really quite rewarding in its way. Yes, thank you.
Carly Nix recorded and edited this conversation with help from Mary McGrath. Catherine Powers' book is called Suitable Accommodations, an autobiographical story of family life, the letters of her father, J.F. Powers. This conversation about writing and life, Irish, Catholic, American, then, now, and otherwise, is not over until listeners like you add your two bits in a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the Open Source Project.